Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders Fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific. 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland, and I'm your hostess for this evening. And I'm brought to you all through the good offices of PatriotFamilies.com, a great group of people who believe, as Johnny Cash said, that we are the nation. And if we don't do it, government will. And that's not exactly what this nation was founded on. Tonight's topic, ladies and gentlemen, is what are our education dollars buying? To highlight what we're getting for what we pay, I had a sixth grader today who's just been 9 months almost studying American history from the 1600s through the Civil War years. And he was totally unaware that the capital of our nation is named after its first president. He also was baffled as to why there were so many monuments and museums in Washington, D.C. This is the same child who, when required to fill out a worksheet and list the three branches of the federal government and what they do, couldn't even find the chapter section titled The Federal Government in his textbook, because it meant he actually had to read something. And he is perfectly capable of reading, unlike many of his fellow students in sixth grade. But it's too hard. He expected me to walk over and point to the answer in the book so he could copy it onto the worksheet. We spend our tax dollars quite freely on education. We have spent billions of dollars over the last 35 to 40 years trying to achieve functional literacy and basic knowledge of history, science, and mathematics in all of our children. What we have gotten for these billions of dollars is a rank of 27 among developed nations in literacy in their own language, basic mathematics, and an understanding of scientific principles. We have children who graduate from high school who cannot figure out how to write a check or fill out an employment application. We have legislation and regulation and agencies and programs and assistance of practically every kind anybody can think about, and have had for over 30 years. And our public education results have steadily declined for every dollar we spend. We buy new beautiful buildings with atria that have flowering plants, and high schools with television and radio stations, and computer labs with state-of-the-art technology. My school put in 2 years ago a technological marvel called a Promethean board, which works through the teacher's computer and shows on a screen anything and everything from the internet to worksheets, and the teacher can work a problem so that all students can watch her do it. It's a magnificent tool, but a tool is only as good as the willingness of someone to use it and the ability to remember what they used it for. Our kids are becoming addicted to the easy button because in their classes, they are giving pre-digested worksheets and notes that they fill in blanks on, copied directly from a textbook or dictated to them by a teacher. The middle school where I work is currently involved in the standards of learning testing that my state is required to do in order to qualify for funding for programs like No Child Left Behind and assistance to children with special needs and special education personnel to deal with the children who have special needs, and individualized education plans that accommodate children with various forms of disability so that they can supposedly learn at their own pace and in their own style and still keep up with everybody else in their collaborative classes. The standards of learning tests at my school this year for 6th and 7th grades are measuring their competency in three subjects: reading and English, social studies, which this year is history for 6th and 7th grade, American history, and mathematics. Our 8th graders are being tested in all four areas of their core curriculum: reading and English, social studies, in their case, civics, mathematics, and science. The test scores that they achieve will be used to evaluate whether or not they have achieved basic competency in their grade level so that they are prepared to go on to the next grade's work. And they will also be used to measure whether or not our school is suitably functioning highly enough to deserve the federal funding that supports special needs children, individualized education plans, new technology grants, allocated funding for personnel to deal with special education and the needs of special needs children, technology innovations that we sometimes are allowed to purchase. All these things are going to depend upon how many of our students achieve the minimum competency score on the state standards of learning. Like every other state in the nation, we are required to have such standards of learning in order to meet the mandates by the Federal Department of Education under No Child Left Behind. Well, No Child Left Behind, signed into law by George Bush, was the product of a democratically controlled House and Senate. And had he vetoed it, it would have gone straight back to Congress and been passed over his veto, and he knew it. It was touted as a way to make sure that our children are not ignored if they have difficulties, and that they will be given every possible aid to become competent citizens in the areas of reading, mathematics, science, and social studies. Unfortunately, all the hype and all the good feeling and all the compassion and all the wonderful, gee, aren't we kind to our children, propaganda, forgot to mention the fact that No Child Left Behind requires an impossible, oxymoronic plan for educating children in public schools. It requires that all children be taught in an individual manner that suits their talents, skills, weaknesses, strengths, specific learning disabilities, physical disabilities, emotional disabilities, and any other kind of disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act as applied to education, and still achieve competency on a chronological scale per grade level. This cannot be done, ladies and gentlemen. It is an example of the mechanistic mindset of progressives in our government and our educational system. They've been around in education for about 90 years now, close to it, ever since John Dewey and his love affair with Soviet schools, and his belief that children need to be to do hands-on learning, and that our job as teachers is to make them amenable and obedient members of the citizen group, and that the group integrity matters much more than individual expertise or academic success. When you tell a child that because they have a disability or don't learn at the same pace or in the same way as everybody else, that they will be accommodated all through school, you set them up to believe that the world will accommodate them in the same way. When you give them an A because they got 100 on their reading paper and they are in seventh grade and reading on second grade level, the report card you send home to their parents looks wonderful and lies through its teeth. It is not possible, ladies and gentlemen, without more billions and billions of dollars, to give each and every child in our public school system one-on-one education. And one-on-one education is the only way that you can accommodate and pace to each child's individual learning style, skills, strengths, and weaknesses. It is not possible to achieve. And yet, we are telling our teachers, our parents, our students, and our administrators that we can and must achieve this. And we are spending more and more and more money proving that we can't. Teachers stay in the profession less than 5 years. Teacher hours are more devoted to paperwork and lesson planning and accommodations for IEPs and meetings and department get-togethers than they are to actually teaching in a classroom. I know many absolutely wonderful teachers. I work with them. But because they are mandated by federal interference in our public schools to provide passing grades to any and all kids so that their self-esteem won't be harmed, they cannot teach. And because are being told that they don't have to learn anything. It's too hard for them. The youngster I mentioned earlier in the show, who couldn't find the chapter in his textbook that listed the three branches of government and explained what they did, couldn't find it because he has been allowed to get by with, "It's too hard. Somebody has to help me." My friend Kara in the chat room just said that her husband, who has a Bachelor of Arts in History and a Master's in Secondary Ed, quit teaching after 2 years. And I'll bet I can say why. He got sick and tired of 40 hours a week of paperwork over and above teaching, and children who don't care about learning anything, and who assume that a classroom is a place to text each other, put on makeup, and say that the teacher gave him a bad grade because the teacher didn't like them. This is our public education system, ladies and gentlemen. Talented, brilliant people with knowledge to share with our children are fleeing in droves from a system that is doing nothing more than creating functionally illiterate, spoiled, entitlement-addicted fodder for the progressive state. Our children are not being taught anything. They are being indoctrinated into political ideology. They are being told that the world owes them anything and everything that they want. And they're also being told that the level playing field means everybody gets a trophy and nobody is allowed to excel because it makes people who can't feel bad. They are also being told that if something is difficult, they don't have to do it. The youngster that I mentioned earlier tonight is not mentally challenged. He's a reasonably bright 11, almost 12-year-old boy who has been treated as if he were an incompetent sheep through 6 years of education. He has been spoon-fed, led by the hand, patted on the head, and told he was wonderful because the function of a teacher is to love the students and make them feel good about themselves. And because he has been told these things, as my friend Kyra said, he is lazy. He is perfectly capable of doing these things. But because he hasn't had to, because there have never been any negative consequences for being intellectually lazy, why should he change? My friend Linda said, why can't the teachers get together and protest anything? Because if they do, they won't a job. And they have to feed their families just like we do. And the best of them keep trying in between the paperwork and the gobbledygook and the garbage because there are still some kids in classrooms who actually want to learn and understand that they have to put forth effort to do so. Because they come from homes where those two things are part and parcel of every single day. Success comes from effort, and knowledge is a value for its own sake. The philosophy that created the mess we're in began during the desegregation years. In an effort to make sure that black youngsters coming from segregated schools, particularly in rural areas, being bused to suburban areas with mostly white middle-class populations, would not feel overwhelmed or stupid by not knowing things that most of the suburban kids did. So standards were lowered on the mistaken assumption that these black children, supposedly undereducated, would eventually catch up and equal their suburban white peers. It didn't work. It never had a shot in hell. The vast majority of kids who came from black schools worked twice as hard as the white kids in the suburban schools did, with less material, less funding, and less teachers. But they had parents who understood that their only route to success was education. And even though they may not have been well-educated themselves, they busted their butts to see that their children were. They didn't stand in line with their hands out saying, give me a degree because I'm poor and black and you enslaved my great-great-granddaddy and you owe it to me. They wanted desegregation because they wanted their kids to have the same opportunity to learn as everybody else in the country. Martin Luther King did not give his I Have a Dream speech to get equal stuff in everybody's house, contrary to Al Sharpton's belief. He gave it because he believed that one's color mattered less than one's character, and that color was not the reason that black Americans were not successful. It was lack of opportunity to try. We have taken one of the greatest opportunities in the history of mankind, free public education, and turned it into a nightmare. We have created a monster, ladies and gentlemen, much more destructive, much more likely to cause mayhem and murder than anything Dr. Frankenstein could have done in his laboratory. And we've done it because we were quote unquote compassionate and caring and kind and concerned about keeping our children children for their entire lives. We valued their innocence and sweetness so much that we told them that they never had to grow up. We told our teachers that they were to be surrogate parents, surrogate ministers, surrogate psychologists, surrogate social workers, surrogate mummies and daddies and aunts and uncles and grandmothers and brothers and sisters and friends and buddies and pals and coaches. They were to take over the formation of our children and their eventual, hopefully, arrival in adulthood. And they were also told that they had to do this and do it perfectly without any assistance from anybody, including the students who were supposed to be learning in their classrooms. Universities that produce our teachers teach them in their college education courses that if a student isn't learning, it is all their fault. And that having a teaching degree is a magic wand. That if you just use it correctly, everybody in the classroom will get an A. This is ridiculous, ladies and gentlemen. I have been involved in education for over 40 years. People aren't pieces of a machine. Children are not cogs in an engine. They are not machine parts. They are individuals Some of them are nice. Some of them aren't. Some of them are smart. Some of them aren't. Some of them care about each other and their fellow beings. Some of them don't. Some of them will never be doctors, lawyers, politicians, professors, officers in the armed forces. Some of them will be those things. Some of them will be educated as if they were going to be and be incompetent at it. Some of them will be doggone good air conditioner repairmen or garage mechanics or assembly line workers or bakers or secretaries or computer programmers or policemen or firemen. No two of them will learn in exactly the same way. And it is not possible, ladies and gentlemen, to be able to pay for what our federal government says we are supposed to produce in our public education. We spend our educational dollars as foolishly as a drunken sailor in a Barcelona brothel. We do all the feel-good stuff and wind up with an educationally transmitted disease known as entitlement addiction. I'm sorry if that analogy offends anyone, but it's quite true. Our founding fathers understood the benefit of learning. Many of them were self-educated. Many of them were college-educated. But all of them were lifelong learners. None of them stopped at a certain point and said, I know everything, I don't have to learn anything new. Or, you have nothing to teach me. Or, I don't have to read anymore because I already took a test on that. None of them expected an easy button. Even the very wealthy ones. None of them were permitted to get by with the kind of behavioral disabilities that leave children who are disruptive and potentially dangerous in classrooms. Because the administrators are scared to death about being sued if they expel the kid. Karen Kara said she was a wealthy mom and taught her kids how to break the habit of entitlement, and they're all successfully and gainfully employed. And she is to be congratulated and given a medal. God bless her. Because it isn't the school or the teacher or the Federal Department of Education, who inculcates a desire for learning, it is the family, the parent. And if we are lucky, our teachers nurture that basic inculcation and help it to grow into a flourishing tree. Teachers cannot be parents, ladies and gentlemen, and they cannot be buddies to children. I know many teachers who have their students as Facebook friends. I would no more friend one of the children I teach than I would walk out of my front door with no clothes on. If you are going to present yourself as a source of knowledge, a teacher, you cannot come down to the level of a 12-year-old and engage with them in the same type of discourse and interests that they have with fellow 12-year-olds. You can't be a child and teach children. Progressives apparently haven't figured that out yet because none of them have gotten past the age of about 13. You cannot be a buddy to a student you are attempting to teach. It is impossible for children to learn in chaos. at least learn academically, learn how to commit chaos very well. As far as remembering that George Washington was the first president of the United States and that our capital is named after him, no, that's not likely to happen. They will learn a great deal about who's dating who and who texted who and who beat up who and what the latest sports scores are and, you know, when can I go to the pool and he poked me or he's a racist, he called me a dirty name. They'll learn all those things. But they won't learn how to do fractions or understand how to convert a decimal to a percent or figure sales tax or how to write a coherent English sentence or what a noun and a verb are. No, they won't learn those things. I've said it before, but it bears repeating, ladies and gentlemen. It is incredibly sad. Sad enough to bring you to tears. When you consider that 9 out of 10 students that I have in my in-school suspension classroom tell me, Mrs. Rowland, I don't like it in here, but boy, I sure got a lot of work done and I learned a lot. That's sad. That's very sad. My friend Linda brings up, too, all the money that's being spent on the breakfast and lunches for the underprivileged and the food police examining children's homemade lunches to see if they're nutritionally correct and the cafeterias that aren't allowed to provide anything children like to eat because it isn't nutritionally correct. We direct our funding, ladies and gentlemen, at things that don't work. Head Start is a prime example. That's been in place for 40 years now. And there is no appreciable difference between the progress of children enrolled in Head Start and children who aren't enrolled in Head Start from the same economic backgrounds by third grade. None. Initially, it was touted as a way to make sure the children from deprived backgrounds would get the nutrition and beginning studies and so on and so forth that they wouldn't get at home. And this would obviously immediately bring them to the level of their peers. No, it didn't. It has no effect whatsoever. No Child Left Behind is a dismal failure. The increased standards that went into effect this year, at least 20 states have gotten waivers from having to meet them because their school can't get the kids to learn even what the standards are now. The money we spend on personnel for collaborative classrooms. For those of you who aren't aware what a collaborative classroom is, it is a classroom that is comprised of 60% average or above average students academically and 40% children with special needs or academic difficulties. There are at least two teachers and one aide in each collaborative classroom. Some collaborative classrooms in which I have worked have had 5 adults in a classroom of 25. 3 teachers and 2 aides. And the classroom was a zoo. Literally. Nobody was paying any attention to what the teacher was saying. Everybody was talking. Nobody was listening to directions. Nobody completed an assignment on time. There were disruptions every 5 minutes with the kids who couldn't behave. Nobody learned a thing. And those 5 people in there for that one class cost the school system approximately $150,000 in yearly salary, accounting benefits and retirement benefits. One classroom with 24 kids in it. The point of applying the Americans with Disabilities Act to public education was supposed to have been to give students with learning disabilities some accommodations so that they could show what they had learned in ways that were slightly different from things like standardized testing. When I worked as a tutor, I had a student who had a learning disability with math. She couldn't pull out of her head individual multiplication packs, but she could write all of her times tables correctly and then use those to do multiplication by 2 and 3 digits. I and my boss went to a meeting at the school with her teachers and the guidance counselor and got them to allow her to do that, to have an extra 10 minutes before the test in math started to sit down and write out her times tables and then use them to do her work. Her math grade went from D to B+. Nobody gave her the answers, but that method gave her the way to show that she knew how to multiply. Nobody gave her a times table chart. She made her own. And then she used it. That worked for her. That accommodation made sense. Because she was, like many children with learning disabilities, quite bright. The vast majority of children who are diagnosed with things like dyslexia and other specific disabilities actually have a higher than average IQ. It's kind of like compensation for it's going to be harder for them to learn, so they have a little bit more ability to once they figure it out, it stays with them and they can apply it to other things. But they, like every other program or good idea in our country under progressives, took it to absurd lengths. I heartily recommend anybody out there who has questions about what I'm talking about to take a look at the website for the Federal Department of Education and the meaning of FAPE, a free appropriate public education, and the accommodations necessary under the Americans with Disabilities Act as it pertains to education for what are called disabilities. Look at the list of things that are now protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act as it pertains to education. You have to look at it because nobody would believe me if I gave you the list. But it's there for any citizen to see. And because it's there, that means accommodations, supposedly written accommodations, must be made for anybody who can conceivably get somebody to say they qualify for any one of those quote-unquote disabilities. One of the students who was one of my repeat offenders in ISS has been removed from our school and will not likely return in the fall. He will be sent to an alternative educational institution. He is one who has an IEP and accommodations, and a behavioral improvement plan, and all of the other paperwork, and teacher instructions as to how they're to teach him and what he's allowed to do and what they tell him to do and so on and so forth. It was faithfully followed. He began a campaign of aggression against another student over a girl on Facebook. And it was an aggressive, violent campaign with threats of physical harm. The teachers, administrators, and guidance knew that this was what he wanted to do and were watching him and talking with him and counseling him and assumed that they had gotten it through his head that this was not appropriate behavior. And then in the hall one day, when the guidance counselor who was with him turned her head for a few moments, he leaped upon the other student in question and started beating him with his fists. Well, the other student was so startled, and for about the first minute and a half, he didn't fight back, and then he proceeded to deck the kid who had threatened him and carried out his threat. I am absolutely amazed that they did anything about it. What they gave the student in question, the aggressor, was 10 days of out-of-school suspension. The parents decided to remove him from school and find an alternative that would teach him that this type of behavior cannot be tolerated. Do not wish to imply that I am in some way anti-disabled persons, or that I believe disabled persons should not be helped or aided, or that a disability makes a person unfit to attend school. Far from it. I worked as a tutor for over 20 years. And many of the students that I dealt with had various types of disabilities, which is why they need extra tutoring outside school hours. Everything from physical handicaps and disabilities to learning disabilities to behavioral difficulties, all sorts of things. I gave them all of myself as a teacher, as I do to every child I teach. But I did not tell them that whatever behavior they were exhibiting that was inappropriate was okay because they couldn't help it. I did not, and neither did my boss, permit behaviors like that. We had an advantage because we were a private business. We could tell the parent that they could no longer bring the student to us. We did it as diplomatically and tactfully as we could, but we did not keep a student who posed a danger to anyone in our establishment. We have a lot of kids out there, ladies and gentlemen, who truly do have great difficulties. Physical, emotional, psychological, and academic, who need a lot of extra attention to succeed and to try to grow up to be able to take care of themselves, to work, to earn enough money so that they can be independent. We also have a great many children who will never be independent. Our public schools are being told that they must provide for all children, no matter the degree of their disability. And we must provide for them all in classrooms where they can and do fail miserably because they simply cannot keep up. My friend Kira said that learning problems don't equal disabilities, and too many like to label them as such, and she's perfectly correct. And they can do it because of the interpretation of a very fine piece of legislation, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was initially created to give those with physical handicaps equal access to governmental services, buildings, and institutions to which they were entitled as citizens of this country. But like every other progressive idea, or every other good idea in the hands of progressives, which aren't exactly the same things, it was carried to ridiculous extremes. The young gentleman I talked about a moment ago is an example. Unfortunately, there is a mindset among many people who call themselves liberal that we can somehow or other make a like and equal mean the same thing. That if we just level the playing field and make everybody equal, everybody will be alike. That is not possible, ladies and gentlemen. It never will be possible without a totally ironclad, violently enforced program of eugenics. And even then, it is unlikely to succeed. Because there will always be somebody who will slip through the cracks of the perfect citizen bred to be a clone and go off in a corner somewhere and gather some other individuals and overthrow those who wish to impose it. It is both our blessing and our curse that we are individuals. It is our blessing because it gives us our creativity, our ability to innovate, our curiosity, our desire to find out what would happen if, our need to communicate with one another and find better ways to do things. It is our curse because individuality means that we will not always agree on what is the best thing for everyone, and that not everyone will always succeed. Unfortunately, our progressive government, and it is a progressive government, ladies and gentlemen, is doing its best to convince us that kindness and compassion are another pair of terms for Everybody has to have all choice eliminated so they cannot make bad choices. And that true freedom is total obedience to the state. And that what matters are equal things and not equal opportunity. The billions and billions of dollars that we spend every day as a nation for things like solar panel companies that are a poor risk and go bankrupt 20 minutes after they get several million dollars, or electric automobiles, sports cars, that if you let the battery run dry, you might as well just put it on the junk heap because you'll never be able to get it to work again. Or educational programs that accommodate children into stupidity and illiteracy. We can change things, ladies and gentlemen, but we won't unless we understand what's going wrong. Progressive thinking wants all of us, as my friend Bill just said in the chat room, to remain infants, nurtured, cared for, protected, and bottle fed. We're all to be protected from ourselves. We're all to be wrapped in swaddling clothes and fed from a bottle in a nice, safe crib and given another bottle when we cry for freedom and having our swaddling clothes wrapped tighter. We have to be protected from making mistakes. And the only way we can protect ourselves from making mistakes is if we never do anything. Because those are the only people who don't make mistakes. We have to be protected so that we cannot grow up. We cannot have an unusual idea. We cannot say something that might offend someone. We cannot think something that might offend someone. We cannot believe something that might offend someone. We must become homogenized milkshakes, all vanilla. Because the minute somebody wants chocolate, somebody else is going to be offended. Or not everybody can get chocolate. Or chocolate isn't good for you. Or some people are allergic to it. We have to be vanilla milkshakes, and we have to make our children vanilla milkshakes. We can stop this, ladies and gentlemen, if we understand this is what they are trying to do. Look beyond the feel-good adjectives like kindness and compassion, nouns, actually, and the No Child Left Behind hype of how we're going to be so sure that we're going to make every child fit to go to college. And that the function of a teacher is supposed to love all of her students or his students and make them feel good about themselves, even if they can't add two and two and get four twice in a row. Because what matters isn't knowledge and innovation and creativity and thinking outside the box and freedom. What matters is self-esteem and not offending people. We can stop it. We can go to school board meetings and volunteer in our classrooms and attend parent-teacher organization meetings, and listen to the teacher when the teacher explains why little Johnny got a D on his test, because little Johnny was busy in the back room, back of the room, playing poker with somebody and listening to a word the teacher said. We have got to stop spoon-feeding our kids and spoon-feeding their parents. We have got to stop thinking it's a wonderful idea to go and occupy the financial district in New York because you don't want to pay your student loans. We have got to stop telling our kids that everybody has to go to college because if you don't, you won't get a good job. That is as big a lie as the level playing field. There are plenty of good jobs that pay quite well that don't require a college education. And you don't have to go to college to be educated. All you have to do is be able to read. And if you can read, and if you can understand what you read, you will educate yourself. And you will not fall into the trap of the put your hand out and I'll give you something tasty. Just give me your freedom and you can have anything you want. Just don't say anything and the government will provide. We have to teach our children ourselves. We cannot give over our parental responsibilities to a government institution. I don't care which one it is. Not everyone is able to homeschool their kids, ladies and gentlemen. It's a full-time job, and if you work full-time and are a single parent, or you have two parents working full-time to maintain a reasonable home and health care and food and some necessary luxuries for your family, it's difficult to cut back and stay home and teach your kids. But we can demand a change in the everybody goes to public school because it's free mentality. We can demand of our state legislatures that they make it easy to homeschool and send your child to a private school whose rules, regulations, classroom size, teaching methods suit your child's learning skills or weaknesses, instead of being lumped in a class with a 60-40 percentage where nobody learns anything. And we have to stop masking stupidity with compassion. I have all the compassion in the world for someone who is ignorant. I have none for someone who is stupid. Ignorance is curable, ladies and gentlemen. Stupidity is not. And we have allowed ourselves to be stupid about how we educate our children for a very long time. We are not stupid. We are bright, intelligent, interested, adult human beings. And we would like our children to become like us in that respect. Not clones, not carbon copies, not sheep following a bellwether. Not cogs in a societal machine. But they will become that if we don't stand up and put a stop to it. We have to do it, ladies and gentlemen. Every single one of us. In whatever way we can. If it means standing on a street corner. Excuse me. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, I had a bit of a coughing fit here. If we can, we have to stand on a street corner and shout about what's going on. We can't be complacent and we can't any longer blindly trust government and government institutions to do for us everything, including things that we should and can do for ourselves. We cannot buy the easy button, ladies and gentlemen. People like my friend Kira, who understood that for her children to have the opportunity she wanted for them, she was going to have to sacrifice. And she was going to have to make sure that they had the chance to learn, really learn. She is the kind of person that every parent should be. And I give her a standing ovation for it. And there are many people out there who care, who understand that opportunity doesn't mean guaranteed success. And education doesn't mean getting a grade that you haven't earned because nobody wants you to feel bad. And understand that if you want something, you're going to have to put forth effort to get it. And you get tired when you do. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen. When I get passionate about something, especially when my sinuses are acting up, I usually wind up having to cough myself half out of my chair, but I'm still here and I promise I will be for the rest of our show tonight and all the shows in the future. I'm only one little old lady, ladies and gentlemen. I can change the world all by myself with one talk show. But I can do what it is in me to do. I can teach children. I can model for them the principles that I believe in. I can come here on Blog Talk Radio and visit the family website and tell you what's going on and give you my ideas and my beliefs. And I can keep doing what I do on the off chance and the hope that one child a day might learn something in my classroom. I may never know what they did or not. I may never hear that they've been successful. I may never know whether or not something that I said struck a spark. But I hope and believe that all of those things happen. It's what keeps me doing what I do. It keeps me going. All the good teachers out there feel the same way that I do. I'm hoping that one of these days, one of the teachers out there will call in and tell us just how many hours a day they spend on paperwork and how many parent-teacher conferences end up with them being vilified because the child refuses to do their homework and gets an F, and it's the teacher's fault. And they can remain anonymous, and they can give a pseudonym, and they don't have to tell me where they're from, or you either. But they, too, are parents. They are as much frustrated as I am and as you are. But they hang in there in the hopes that they can reach somebody. If they're teachers, born teachers, and good teachers, they do their best to hang in. Sometimes they just can't. Sometimes it gets to the point that they are burned out because everything they do, everything that they put forth, all of the knowledge that they have and they try to share is treated as if it were waste paper thrown on a trash heap. And they're vilified and criticized and hauled on the carpet because they aren't God and they aren't perfect and they can't cure stupid. We have an unusual, I guess you could say, dual personality view of teaching and education in this country, ladies and gentlemen. We believe as a nation that education is important. That's why we spend so much money on it. We believe that teachers are important, which is why we spend not quite so much money on them in some places and way too much money on them in others. But we also, many of us, believe that ridiculous old saying, if you can't do, teach. And that a highly educated person is automatically a snob and looks down their nose at the guy who works on cars for a living. It makes it difficult, ladies and gentlemen, because it isn't true. Neither one of those views is completely true. Yes, education is important, but it isn't important in the sense that we've got to pour money down a rat hole to have bigger and prettier toys in it. It's important because we have to teach our kids that they are going to need to educate themselves as long as they live. And it isn't true that all well-educated people look down their noses at the guy who fixes their car. I certainly don't, because I can't fix it. He knows a heck of a lot more about it than I do. And I am eternally grateful that he does, because otherwise I wouldn't have wheels and couldn't get to work. We've got to come back to the understanding that education begins at home. It begins with parents who teach their children not only how to walk and talk, but how to behave. And teach their children the manners and courtesies they need before they arrive in kindergarten, so the teachers aren't spending all of their time trying to keep little Johnny from bashing in the head of little Susie. And we have got to take a good hard look at the burgeoning, ridiculous accommodations under the interpretation of the Americans with Disabilities Act as it applies to schools. As I said earlier, a genuinely good idea has mushroomed into a Frankensteinian monster that is depriving our kids, all of our kids, including those who are quote-unquote disabled, with the opportunity to learn and succeed by their own efforts. We can do it, ladies and gentlemen. We can. Like the pebble that rolls down the hill and hits another pebble that hits another pebble and another, and pretty soon you have an avalanche, we can do it. We can vet the people who say they're going to serve us in government. And we can ask them the hard questions and not accept platitudes and for an answer. And we can get over the idea that anybody can make life a level playing field. And we can accept the reality that compassion doesn't come from government, it comes from individual human hearts. And we can recognize that there is no such thing as the easy button. And we can also understand that technology makes a wonderful servant, but a very poor master. All the laptops and Promethean boards and computer-assisted technology in the world will do nothing if a child does not care to learn. And the desire to learn is not implanted by his kindergarten teacher. It's implanted from birth by his parents, by both precept and example. If we aren't willing to be lifelong learners, our children will not be. We cannot turn over that responsibility to the schools either. And many people have. We cannot accept hearing our child say, "Oh, well, I don't have to know that. We had a test on it last week, so I don't have to know it anymore." We can pull them up by the scruff of the neck gently and say, "Oh, yes, you do. You've got to know that when you're 75. One benefit of being an old lady in my profession is that I have the life experience to be able to tell these kids, based on things I know and have done, that if you are not a lifelong learner, you're going to be left by the side of the road with a tin cup and a blanket and nowhere to sleep. the technology that I use as a matter of course now didn't exist when I was in middle school. It didn't exist when I was in college. I had to teach myself how to use it. If I had bought into the, oh, well, I don't have to learn anything more, I've got a test on it last week so I can forget about it, mentality, I'd probably be living in a cardboard box somewhere. Because no matter what I knew or how good I was at something or other, I would not be able to hold a job if I couldn't use a computer. I can tell my students this because they know that I have had this experience. I can demonstrate to them that I am still learning and intend to be until I drop over dead behind my desk in an in-school suspension room. Or get run over by a very large truck crossing the street to get to my car, leaving my in-school suspension room. I do not believe, ladies and gentlemen, that a teacher is made by a piece of paper from a college. I believe that every single adult living is a teacher. We have to be. It is our responsibility and our trust to teach our children, all of them. My friend Kira said, she asked a neighbor's child, what was the one thing he learned this year? And he learned they had to pass their state's standards of learning test. But as far as anything they might be tested on to see if they knew it, he had no idea. This is not uncommon, ladies and gentlemen. It's all too common. The fact that we have a sixth grader who has no clue that the capital of our country is named after its first president should tell you something. I believe that we can turn it around. We can change things because those of us who are seeing this and hearing this and watching the people who are occupying this, that, and the other, and their total lack of common sense, let alone knowledge, are waking up to the fact that if we don't stand up and say something and do something, we are headed to the hot place in a handbasket. We cannot compete in this world, ladies and gentlemen, if we tell our children that competition is evil. We cannot remain a beacon of light and freedom if we teach our children to be dependent slaves. We cannot make the world a better place if we tell the world, give me, give me, give me, while I sit here and wait for it. That is not compassion, ladies and gentlemen. That is not kindness. That is not caring for our lesser brethren. That is destroying the human race. We have gotten to the top of the food chain because of our opposable thumbs, our curiosity, our skill as tool makers, and our ability to innovate. Those things keep us viable as a species. Our public education system is doing everything it can to minimize our ability to use those things. We have to stand up and speak out. We have to monitor what the children we know, not just our own, but our neighbors' kids, our nieces, our nephews, our grandchildren, the kid in Walmart with his mommy. We have to pay attention to what they know and what they don't, and what attitudes they are learning in school, not just what facts. We have got to stop waiting for government to cure obesity by refusing to let us buy an oversized soda pop. We have got to stop buying the poisoned candy of progressive educational philosophy. No, it's not always the teacher's fault that little Johnny can't read. Sometimes it's little Johnny's fault, because little Johnny doesn't give a rat's behind whether he learns anything or not. Sometimes it's little Johnny's mommy and daddy's fault, because little Johnny's practice at home gets set aside in favor of the electronic babysitter or putting him in his bedroom with a Nintendo DS that won't bother them. Or little Johnny just doesn't have a functioning brain for whatever reason. I grew up during a time, an evil time, when children were trapped. Oh my God, what a horrible thought. They were steered toward either vocational training or academic higher education. What an amazingly awful thing to do to children. Just think how badly the kids in the vocational steering program felt, and how their self-esteem was wounded because they weren't in the academic classes and they didn't get to be valedictorian. Well, many of those children in that horrible tracking system wound up as millionaires, not because they went to college, but because they worked with their hands, started their own business, and grew it until it covered about 5 states. And many of those who went to college wound up at Haight-Ashbury, toking away and loving the free love, man. The tracking that was done was not a means of forcing children into a path that they didn't want or couldn't do. It was a sensible approach to the reality that people are different, and that some people's skills lie in the arena of craftsmanship and others in the arena of academic and intellectual pursuits. And that it was just as ridiculous to take a good potential mechanic and try to turn him into a lawyer as it was to take a potentially brilliant lawyer and put him on an assembly line at the local auto plant. But, oh, that was bad. You can't do that. There's a damage to self-esteem and an unlevel playing field. And some people got trophies and other people didn't. And they felt bad about it. And they cried. We can't have that. Unfortunately, we have drifted so far away from the real understanding of what tough love is. Tough love is not beating your children. It's not stifling their creativity or forcing them to be what you want them to be, or denying them interaction with their friends and peers. No, that's not tough love. Tough love is the ability of a parent to say no and deal with a temper tantrum when yes would put their child in danger or among people whose morals and ethics totally contravened what you were trying to teach your child. I got told no quite a lot. I also got told yes quite a lot. I got told no when what I wanted to do was going to damage me in some fashion or might potentially put me in a dangerous situation or lead me to make bad or uninformed choices. I got told yes when I wanted to try something new and maybe wouldn't be really good at it, but I wanted very badly to try. I got told yes when I wanted to learn about something that wasn't necessarily in the textbook, or I asked a question and wanted an answer, and I didn't get, go look it up. I got an answer. I was told no, and it was explained to me why I was told no. I had rules under which I had to live, and they were explained to me as well. My students in my ISS room have rules under which they have to operate. The rules are a nice big font on a piece of cardboard, laminated and on the wall on my desk where they can all see it. And at the beginning of every day, I go over those rules early. I explain why they are there. And I explain that the consequences of not following the rules will be immediate and unpleasant. The vast majority of kids that I get in my classroom fall into two categories. The ones who don't engage brain before opening mouth, and the ones who assume that rules don't apply to them because they're special. Well, I'll repeat what I said earlier that was so sad, that 9 out of 10 of my students leave my ISS room with the remark, you know, I don't really like it in here, but I sure did get a lot of work done, and I learned something. One of my fellow teachers made a comment on Facebook the other day that he would really love to teach at Hogwarts. So would I. My students are addressed by their surname and an honorific. I do not call them by their first name. Many of them ask me why. And I explain to them exactly, truthfully, why. Number one, I expect them to be courteous and respectful to me. And with the golden rule, I treat them courteously and respectfully. Number two, I am not their friend, their buddy, their playmate, their mother, their grandmother, their brother, their sister. I am their teacher. And they don't have any problem with it. And the vast majority of them, once they leave my happy little jail, at least once or twice a month, they'll come by, poke their head in the door, and say, hi, Ms. Roland, how are you today? How many kids do you know that would do that to somebody who is in authority over their punishment? And it's punishment. They lose a lot of privileges. But these kids aren't stupid, ladies and gentlemen. They're ignorant. And ignorance I can cure. Even if it's only in tiny little increments, I can cure that. And so can we all. If we remember that we're all teachers, and that every single one of us has a responsibility to watch what's done with our money when it comes to education, and to put our foot down and say no, and not reelect people who continue to support programs that are obvious failures, and not believe the compassionate lies that are attempting to indoctrinate our children into complacent sheep or cogs in a machine. We have the power. We are the nation. And if enough of us little pebbles start rattling around together, we will make that avalanche of real, positive change. Not change as a slogan, or change as a rattle of coins in our pocket, but change in the way we look at what we want from this nation and its citizens, current and future, and how we can best get those things to come true. Please, all of you out there listening, come and join us here on Blog Talk Radio for our Patriot Family Radio shows. There's one on every night to educate, entertain, and awaken everyone. On Sundays, Frank is fed up with Ron Golden. Constitution Hour every Monday with our friend Ron. Tuesday, Patriot Family Chat with Bill Strong and Hollis Buchanan. Two great guys who understand what it means to work for what you want. And who understand that sometimes sacrifice is the only way you're going to get there. Every Wednesday, that lovely bird of paradise, Linda Sills, the California conservative with Right from the Left Coast, who's out there putting her boots on the ground, going to city council meetings, talking to people, going door to door, fighting to get candidates elected who believe that this nation is great and will and can remain so. And here on Education every Thursday at 7 p.m., where I sound a little on what I see and what I think we can do. And maybe we throw in a little funny every now and again, but mostly we look at the tragedy that's unfolding, and I hope I can get us all to stand up and make it into a happy ending. And on Fridays, foreclosure help. For those of us who are facing the downturn in the housing market and the economy and trying to find ways to cope and keep a roof over our head. And Mr. Magic on Saturdays with Breaking the Illusion. And visit us at our website, www.patriotfamilies.com. That's www.patriotfamilies.com. You've got great bloggers and great conversations. And great links to articles and information. People who care about this country and about one another, who believe we are the nation and that we will take it back. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, you are all teachers. Every single one of you. And you're good at it. Because you believe in something and you are to stand up and say so. Thank you to my friends and fellow family members in the chat room. You all are terrific people in your own right, and believe me, without your support, I don't think I could keep doing what I do, both here on Blog Talk and in the schools. Knowing that what I do can reach somebody and give somebody something of value keeps me going, and every single one of you contribute to that. Have a wonderful evening, everyone, and do come back to see us next Thursday, barring thunderstorms. And my thanks again to everybody in the Patriot family, those here in the chat room and those blogging and talking and going out there and campaigning for people who believe in America the way she has been and can be again. A country of freedom and integrity and individual responsibility, innovation, creativity, free markets, and the willingness to stand up and be counted when the chips are down. Hope to see you again next Thursday. God bless you all, and good night.